I next met with Dr. David Ryan to talk a bit about pancreatic cancer. And to begin, I asked him what were the most common questions he received from oncologists about this challenging neoplasm.
I'd say the number one issue that we receive right now is the whole FOLFIRINOX question. Do I use it? How do I use it? Is it really real? The community docs definitely want to know what our experience has been to date with FOLFIRINOX. I would say the answer is that it's definitely real. You are seeing responses and durable responses that you rarely saw with gemcitabine. I used to call it the gemcitabine stress test, where you give somebody a month or two of gemcitabine. Usually after a month, sometimes 6 weeks of gemcitabine, you had a pretty good idea if they were going to be in that special 5 to 10% that got a significant amount of extra time from the gemcitabine. And oftentimes, unfortunately, people would just fall off the cliff in those 6 weeks with pancreatic cancer. With FOLFIRINOX, we're starting to see responses, kind of what you see in colon cancer almost, in the sense that you actually have tumor shrinkage, you have people feeling a lot better, almost to the point where you expect to see the response, you want to see a response. The problem with FOLFIRINOX is that it's really difficult to give and give safely. You have to be very aware that patients get dehydrated incredibly quickly. So with pancreatic cancer, there's an underlying nausea and pain issue so that people aren't eating and drinking as much as they should, plus the anorexia and cachexia that just takes place. And oftentimes with pancreatic cancer, there's often a mild delay in diagnosis, I'd say, where people have been sick for about 6 months. And everybody has belly pain, so the first couple of visits to the doctor, they're put on Prilosec, and it's vague, and it comes and goes. So they're not in the greatest shape. They're not like your typical colon cancer patient who we would treat with FOLFIRINOX or FOLFOXIRI, the equivalent. And so where you run into trouble with FOLFIRINOX is because people aren't eating and drinking, because they have a baseline nausea from the pancreatic cancer, they get dehydrated incredibly quickly. And so you have to be very aggressive about the hydration for these folks. So far, it's been pretty good, though, if you are, and you can generally get people on a dose and a schedule that's good for them. I'd say we wind up reducing about half the patients that go on FOLFIRINOX.
Do you use preemptive, you know, IV fluids, for example?
Yeah, we do at Mass General, for sure. So we use preemptive IV fluids. It's very important to make sure that folks are taking both ondansetron and dacadron for anti-nausea. We often quickly move to amend if that doesn't work. But ondansetron alone, for sure, you'll have some breakthrough nausea. And so using ondansetron with dacadron is very important. I know a lot of folks with pancreatic cancer leave the dacadron out because the sugars are already a little bit high.
What about older patients with FOLFIRINOX? There's a lot of hesitancy about that.
There sure is, and rightfully so, because a lot of the older folks have difficulty keeping themselves hydrated and dealing with the pain and constipation issues that come up from using the pain regimens. And so we have found definitely folks who are older have a more difficult time, and you have to be very careful about doing FOLFIRINOX. A lot of times people will start with FOLFOX. We're seeing that more and more, and adding in the irinotecan after people demonstrate that they can tolerate at least FOLFOX.
What about adjuvant or neoadjuvant FOLFIRINOX?
We are currently putting together our data for folks who have locally advanced disease that we initiated on first-line FOLFIRINOX to see if we could convert some of those folks from unresectable to resectable. And so we're looking at our data. Anecdotally, I can tell you that there have been some folks who have been resected after being deemed locally advanced. The problem with the locally advanced patient or the borderline locally advanced patient is that that definition sometimes is in the eye of the beholder. And some surgeons will say, I think it's locally advanced and wrapped around the celiac axis, or it's wrapped around the SMA, I can't get it out. Other surgeons will look at the SMV and say it's wrapped around the SMV, therefore it's locally advanced, but the arterial supply is intact and not involved. In those cases, they're very different types of patients. Someone who has no arterial involvement, you're always going to look really hard to see if you can get all that tumor out. And so we're collecting that data. Others are collecting that data, and we'll have a pretty good sense of, for the borderline locally advanced patient or the true locally advanced patient, are we really converting folks to resectable disease?
This is a study or just your experiences?
This is our experience so far. And we're in the middle of putting that experience together. So folks who have locally advanced disease clearly are not curable, and the standard of care is to give them the most aggressive chemotherapy regimen that you would give for stage 4 disease. And so naturally, for people with truly locally advanced disease, we've started using FOLFIRINOX. In terms of the adjuvant setting, I would say that we have not routinely used FOLFIRINOX in the adjuvant setting. Although there are patients and doctors who will use FOLFIRINOX in the adjuvant setting, and I'll give you, for instance, somebody comes in after a pancreatic cancer resection and has 10 or 12 positive lymph nodes. The data would suggest that at least 95% of those patients are going to recur with metastatic pancreatic cancer in the very short term. And should we not just classify them as having metastatic pancreatic cancer and use the most aggressive regimen there? It's certainly something that could be considered in that kind of a situation, but routinely, no, we haven't done it. And there's not any data to say it's safe to do in the immediate postoperative setting right now.
Can you talk about the issue of locally advanced pancreatic cancer and how you approach it?
The reasons why people are locally advanced and unresectable are several. So an absolute contraindication to resection is tumor that's wrapping around the arterial supply. And the arterial supply is typically either the celiac axis or the SMA. Those would be considered locally advanced in anybody's view. Then you have people who have maybe tumor going up to the celiac axis or going up to the SMA, but it's not truly wrapping around the artery. In those folks, sometimes what the radiologist says is going up to the artery is not actually tumor, but is actually inflammation. There can be a brisk inflammation or pancreatitis around the tumor, and you can get fooled sometimes. The second major reason why people are locally advanced is because they have venous involvement, typically SMV or portal vein. And if the SMV or portal vein are encased, then the tumor is considered locally advanced and unresectable. But these veins can be grafted, the SMV in part can be grafted, and there are surgical techniques to take out tumors with just partial or minimal involvement of the vein. And so that's where you get into the borderline resectable pancreatic cancer, where some surgeons would say, well, that's definitely unresectable, and others would say, well, I think I can get that out and graft that vein.
I mean, does it really change the surgical procedure if you get tumor regression, or is it just kind of like, well, encouraging that you have maybe systemic control?
Well, I think it's encouraging that you have systemic control. The major reason I think that arterial involvement predicts locally advanced disease is that if you see the tumor going out to the arteries, generally speaking, you're going to wind up with an R1 resection. And have you really benefited patients with an R1 resection? There are some long-term survivors from R1 resections, but generally speaking, those are 10% or fewer. And so there's two things. One is the patient who has locally advanced disease is very likely to have occult metastatic disease that will become evident in the next several months. But the second is you want somebody who does go to surgery to have an R0 resection, if at all possible. So I think that for folks who have a vigorous response on FOLFIRINOX with locally advanced disease, we are encouraging our surgeons to take them back to the OR and make sure that that wasn't just inflammation going up to the artery or inflammation going up to the vein, but is actually cancer and it truly is locally advanced. And when you see a great response and the tumor kind of shrink away from the artery or vein, you get that much more excited that you can offer a potentially curative resection. Whether or not that's going to turn out to be the case, we'll find out as multiple centers start publishing their experience.
What about adjuvant therapy of pancreatic cancer? What do you think are reasonable, you know, evidence-based options, and what do you actually do outside of protocol?
So that's probably the second biggest question that I get in the pancreatic cancer arena, and it has to do with the use of radiation. And they say, Dave, are you really using radiation in the adjuvant setting? There's a divide between Europe and the Americas. And the divide is that in the Americas, we typically say that these patients have a very high risk of local recurrence. Chemoradiation improves the local regional recurrence rate. And if we had better systemic therapy, we would clearly see that you'd have an improvement in survival. Therefore, we still include chemoradiation, typically in the Americas, in the adjuvant therapy for folks with pancreatic cancer. In Europe, they've moved away from it. there have been very disappointing results in the randomized controlled studies. Typically, what started it all was the SPAC study, which did not find a benefit to chemoradiation. In fact, there seemed to be maybe even a little bit of worsening of outcome. And so Europe has gone the route of giving 6 months of gemcitabine-based chemotherapy, typically just gemcitabine alone. And so the big question in the adjuvant setting is the chemoradiation worth it? I think on the European side of the ledger, I would say that one of the things going for them is that it is very difficult to deliver upper gastrointestinal tract chemoradiation. Patients don't like it. They get sick. The older the patient is, the sicker they get. We looked at our data for upper GI adjuvant chemoradiation, whether it's pancreas or stomach or esophagus, and found that if people were approaching the age of 80, that there was about a 50% hospitalization rate. That's a very high number, and a very high number for a treatment that hasn't been associated with a definitive improvement in overall survival. On the other side, though, I would say that the local regional recurrence rate is extremely high, that if you are going to have somebody who is hopefully going to be cured and doesn't have any systemic therapy, they still are at incredibly high risk of local regional recurrence, and it's hard to imagine that chemoradiation isn't going to improve that outcome. And so there is an ongoing cooperative group study looking at that question, and whether it finishes accrual or not is probably going to be the big question.
What's the design?
The design is gemcitabine plus or minus erlotinib, and then at the end, patients are randomly assigned to either continue out after, I believe, 5 cycles to continue out with chemoradiation or continue out with gemcitabine with or without erlotinib, depending upon what they were randomized to.
Who's the group doing it?
RTOG.
Sounds like it would need to be a huge study.
Yes, yes.
Is it going to get done?
I don't know. It's not clear to me that it is going to get done, but it is trying to answer a very important question and a question that needs to be answered. Part of the problem, I think, in our approach in the United States anyway, is that postoperative chemoradiation is very difficult to administer or to tolerate. We at MGH much would prefer to deliver preoperative chemoradiation in those patients. It's easier to tolerate. Patients are feeling, generally speaking, much better than after a Whipple, and we can get people through the treatment very easily. And then they go to surgery, and then after surgery, all you have to administer is 4 to 6 months of gemcitabine chemotherapy. That's a much easier regimen.
What's the chemo radiation neoadjuvant treatment specifically?
So typically at Mass General, off protocol, we would administer continuous infusion 5-FU with radiation. Lately, we've been experimenting on protocol with proton beam therapy. What's interesting, and the reason why we went to proton beam therapy, is the advantage of using protons is that you can really paint the dose in and avoid exposing normal tissues to high doses of chemotherapy. So our theory was that we would reduce toxicity, and we can deliver that dose in 5 days. So we did a 5x5 fraction of proton beam preoperative radiation therapy. We've now published on it. We used capecitabine as a radiation sensitizer for just 2 weeks. Patient went to the operating room the following week, and then after recuperating, we gave them gemcitabine chemotherapy. What's interesting is that we showed that not only can we safely do 5x5 gray to the upper GI tract, but it seems that we can't do it with standard radiation. We are now in the middle of a standard radiation, 5x5 gray, but had too much upper GI toxicity, so we had to stop that particular protocol. The advantage of delivering it in 5 fractions is that you're done with the radiation in a week. It's very well tolerated, and our preliminary local control data looks extremely good, just as good as what we see with standard 6-week fractionation.
One of the things an oncologist asked me had to do with what chemo to use during radiation therapy, and specifically whether gemcitabine, maybe at a reduced dose, can be used as opposed to a fluoropyrimidine.
So phase 2 studies have definitely demonstrated that you can use a lower dose of gemcitabine with radiation. The efficacy seems to be probably just as good. I particularly like using 5-FU. I'm more comfortable with it. I think my reading of the literature is that the toxicity profile is slightly better for continuous infusion 5-FU with radiation.
Compared to gemcitabine?
Compared to gemcitabine.
How about compared to capecitabine?
Capecitabine, at least in the rectum, appears to be just as good and not any problems with toxicity for the rectal tumors. For the upper GI tumors, it seems to be okay, although we have much less experience with radiation in that field. The problem with radiating upper GI tracts is that it is that much more toxic than radiating the lower GI tract, the rectum. And so I do worry about using capecitabine for upper GI tract radiation protocols. On the other hand, people are doing it. The phase 2 study suggests it can be done and it can be done safely. And there's no good head-to-head comparison.
How do you approach second-line treatment of metastatic pancreatic cancer? Let's say a patient progresses on FOLFIRINOX or, say, gemcitabine.
So I think that if somebody progresses on FOLFIRINOX, it's very reasonable if they have a good performance status and want to continue doing chemotherapy to administer gemcitabine at that point. For people who start with gemcitabine, I typically then go to second-line FOLFOX. There is a nice CONCO3 study where they used a 5-FU oxaliplatin regimen called OFF, O-F-F. It's not the greatest acronym. But it was stopped early due to poor accrual. But there was a difference in survival between the group that received the 5-FU oxaliplatin combination compared to the group that was just treated with supportive care. And so I think going to second-line FOLFOX or 5-FU oxaliplatin combination of choice, whichever schedule is your favorite, is a perfectly reasonable second-line pancreatic cancer regimen.
Now, you mentioned erlotinib in that study, but what about erlotinib off study?
So erlotinib off study, for all comers, I don't particularly think it's worth it. It improved survival by several weeks on average. What was interesting and what is interesting in pancreatic cancer is that there's a new appreciation that not all pancreatic cancers are KRAS mutant. Several groups now, the Canadian group did that study, a German group have gone back and looked at the mutational status of folks with pancreatic cancer. And in fact, somewhere between 25 and 30% of patients are KRAS wild type. The Canadian study, which went back and looked at the gemcitabine with or without erlotinib phase 3 study, they published their results in Cancer, and to little fanfare, because they didn't see a statistically significant difference between the KRAS mutated folks and the KRAS wild type folks. My own reading of that study is that there was definitely a signal there. The people who were KRAS wild type had a better hazard ratio, a fairly good hazard ratio if they received erlotinib compared to if they didn't. But because of the small numbers that they had to look at, it wasn't statistically significant. And so the conclusion of that particular retrospective study was that KRAS didn't make a difference. I actually think that if you look at it more closely, KRAS may actually make a difference. So that's a long-winded way of saying that we are actually looking at KRAS status now. And if somebody is clearly KRAS mutant, I'm definitely not using erlotinib. But if they're KRAS wild type, I'm certainly considering it and talking to the patient about the side effects and the current controversies about whether erlotinib is worthwhile in the setting of pancreatic cancer. But I think it's worth another look at this point. Not all pancreatic cancer is the same, as we're starting to figure out. And it'll be interesting in the future to look at subsets of patients with pancreatic cancer. For instance, those patients who develop a pancreatic cancer out of an IPMN, intraductal papillary mucinous neoplasm. So if they have the cystic neoplasms of the pancreas, those are the ones that potentially might not have the same KRAS mutation rates.
Maybe you can talk a little bit more about the biology of KRAS and pancreatic cancer. And for example, have EGFR antibodies been used in pancreatic cancer?
They have. So there's a SWOG study looking at gemcitabine with or without cetuximab that was negative in terms of survival. But they did not stratify for KRAS. And if there's a small subset, 20 to 30% that might benefit, then I think that those folks, it should be reevaluated. The problem is that these studies are often driven by the pharmaceutical industry, and they may not be interested in a subset, a 20% subset of pancreatic cancer. And so, unfortunately, we embarked on the erlotinib or the cetuximab studies in pancreatic cancer prior to knowing about the effect of KRAS and the interaction with inhibition of the EGF pathway. KRAS, when it's mutated, is constitutively on, and that pathway is downstream of both erlotinib, the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and also cetuximab or panitumumab. So in colon cancer, for instance, we don't expect people with KRAS mutant colon cancer to respond to either cetuximab or panitumumab. If you look at the older erlotinib data in colon cancer, there was a single-digit response rate in that setting. It wouldn't surprise me if those were KRAS wild type and that maybe there is a role if somebody wanted to go back and look at erlotinib and KRAS wild type or some of the other tyrosine kinase inhibitors of the EGF pathway in KRAS wild type colon cancers. Similarly, I think in KRAS wild type pancreatic cancers, there may be some benefit to going back and looking at that question of utilizing either an antibody to EGFR or a TKI.
You know, pancreatic cancer has been looked at in terms of whole genome sequencing. I'm assuming that there's no sort of EGFR mutation, tumor mutation type of thing in pancreatic cancer or, you know, sort of oncogene addiction.
So interestingly, we have looked at that. Eunice Kwok, an investigator at our institution, she was the lead author of the
crizotinib.
Of crizotinib. She's actually a GI oncologist.
That's right.
And she's responsible for the clinical operations of the experimental therapeutics group. Wonderful physician, wonderful colleague. She started the crizotinib study because she was actually looking at finding a therapy for MET amplified gastric cancer. And when she fell upon the responses in the initial patients with ALK translocated lung cancer, it just took off into the lung cancer world. So Eunice Kwok, one of her first studies that she did as a young investigator, she had just come out of Daniel Haber's lab to join the clinical team. Daniel Haber's our cancer center director. And Daniel Haber, of course, was very instrumental in the early days of the EGF mutation data in lung cancer, along with Tom Lynch. And so Eunice Kwok was coming out of the lab, and we said, geez, Eunice, it would be interesting to look. We're using erlotinib now in pancreatic cancer. And so she looked at a retrospective cohort of patients, and we did find the EGF mutation. It was present, I believe, in 2 of 50 patients. Pancreatic cancer, somewhere along those lines, 2 of 50 patients, roughly. What was interesting is we were doing at that time a second-line study of capecitabine and erlotinib, principally for folks who had not received first-line erlotinib, to see if in the second line it had a activity. What we found, interestingly, was that the two patients that were mutated were both on that particular study. And there was a sense, anyway, that those folks had a slightly better response, if you will. They didn't meet objective criteria for RECIST response, but they stayed on study longer. But we saw nothing in those patients like what you see in lung cancer.
Right.
So
the Lazarus kind of thing.
Absolutely. So while EGF mutations do occur in pancreatic cancer, uncommonly, but they do occur, the tumor isn't addicted to that particular pathway.
Anything you hear people talking about the stroma in pancreatic cancer, any kind of sort of anti-stromal strategies?
Well, the big anti-stromal strategy, if it works that way, is the hedgehog inhibitor. So the hedgehog inhibitors that are coming down the pathway, one of the theories is that they might work not so much against the pancreatic cancer itself, per se, but the actual stroma within the cell and allow for better delivery of chemotherapy and better cell kill by chemotherapy. There are a number of hedgehog inhibitors now in clinical trial, and we'll see if that actually plays out.
So I'm just trying to imagine what it's like to sit around your grand rounds. You know, you got Jose Baselga there and all these other people, and, you know, you can pick their brains. But, you know, one person you've got there that I want to ask you about in terms of the final topic about pancreatic cancer, assuming she's still there, is Jennifer Temel, who did a study on palliative medicine and lung cancer. Amazingly, it showed a survival benefit. And, you know, it's hard to think of another cancer where palliative care and supportive care is as important as in pancreatic cancer. Has she or anybody else tried to look at this in pancreatic cancer? And any thoughts or pearls about palliative care in pancreatic cancer?
So Jennifer is a colleague and a friend, and we are absolutely looking at that. We have an ongoing clinical trial now with early palliative care intervention in pancreatic cancer patients, where we are trying to see if the effects that she saw in lung cancer can be duplicated in pancreatic cancer. pancreatic cancer is one of those cancers that people can get very sick very fast, even over the first couple of weeks. And it's incredibly important to jump on pain control, to jump on biliary obstruction, and to jump on the emotional toll it takes. As someone who has taken care of as much pancreatic cancer as anyone over the last 15 years, I am never underwhelmed or underimpressed by what pancreatic cancer can do to a person. Over the course of 4 weeks, it can crush somebody. And emotionally, that takes an enormous toll on the patient and the family. And I think that addressing those issues around anxiety, depression, pain control, biliary obstruction, hydration status, and the like is incredibly important.